One of the cliches we use in talking about societies of long ago is to talk about the wisdom of the ancients. Yes, they had that in some measure, and they had brutality and all the other things you expect of human beings. And they not only set humanity on the path toward the world we know, they did have some connections with each other. It was not globalism in the sense we know it now, but there are some surprises to be had in reading the book called Ancient Worlds, A Global History of Antiquity. Michael Scott is the author. He's an associate professor of ancient history and classics at the University of Warwick in England. He's also the author of several other books, including Delphi, A History of the Center of the World. Michael is also well-versed in broadcasting as the writer and presenter of TV and radio programs for the BBC, National Geographic, and others. Pleasure to have you, Michael Scott.
Jeffrey, it's great to be here. Thanks very much for having me on.
This is a broad topic to undertake. What lack of understanding did you perceive in the modern world of the ancient world that drove it?
Well, I think it was actually started with staring at a bookshelf as many good ideas do. And it was looking at a bookshelf, one of the bookshops here in the UK, of the ancient history kind of materials. And it suddenly struck me that there was an awful lot of books, particularly in my kind of field of origin in the study of the classics, the Greek and Roman societies of the Mediterranean, that lots of those books finished in the ancient world. And, you know, I have to put my own hands up here, mea culpa, the book you just mentioned, you know, Delphi's Center of the Ancient World ends that way too. And I suddenly realized that we were really sort of pulling the wool over our eyes, because when we sort of accepted that conceit of the ancient world, what we were actually meaning was a tiny little bit of it, just the Mediterranean. And there was a much bigger and broader ancient world out there to discover. And at the same time, lots of the work I'd been doing, it just kept cropping up that you couldn't quite get a full picture or understanding of what was going on unless you looked at the way in which the Mediterranean cultures linked into those in, say, the Near East or down into Africa or further up into Europe. And so gradually it became clear to me that we need to take a much broader and border-crossing perspective to be able to understand what the ancient world was really like.
How much interconnection was there? I mean, we obviously not globalism, as I mentioned, in the sense we know it now, with instant communications, but it sounds like there was some cross-pollinating of cultures.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a big argument, really, within the field of global history or world history, which has, you know, really been led by the states, as to whether or not the ancient world can be considered. You know, can you use this word global to describe it? And there are those that say no. You know, there are those that are very firm and say that actually before, I think it's 1571, when Manila was colonized as a Spanish outpost and there was sort of global trade in the modern sense, you can't use the word globalized. It doesn't have any meaning. But on the other hand, there are many, and I would obviously include myself in this, who see interaction between cultures and connectivity, global connectivity, dating back to the very origins of human society. I mean, just recently in Spain, in a Neolithic workshop, say 4,000 years ago, the remains of an Asian elephant have been found. So, you know, clearly there was movement of goods, movement of people, movement as well, of course, as a result of ideas from the earliest phases of man's history. And I think no character sums that up better for me than the man I choose to start the book with, which is Megasthenes. Now, he's a fascinating character of the 4th century BC. So it's in the wake of the big conquests of Alexander the Great after he's died, and this great swathe of land has been connected up between Greece, the Near East, all the way through to India. And in the wake of that, the empires that sort of emerge out of Alexander the Great's great conquests choose to send ambassadors to one another. And Megasthenes is the ambassador, the official ambassador of the Seleucid Empire that was controlling the sort of eastern shores of the Mediterranean through into Central Asia. He's the official ambassador sent by the Seleucids to the court of King Chandragupta in India, at a place called Pataliputra. And he writes a book called Indica, which is his sort of story and vision of his time there as an official ambassador. And on the one hand, it has these wild and wonderful stories of ants that are the size of human beings, for gold.
I remember they'll chase you down for gold.
Yeah, absolutely.
The size of foxes.
Or there's men there that have no noses and eat and breathe through their mouths. Or equally, there are men that have no mouths and eat and breathe through their noses. Or men that have their feet on backwards. So there's all sorts of wonderful and wacky stories, but there's also some really interesting social comparison. You know, there's Megasthenes sitting there in the court of this king going, wow, how does this society survive without slavery? Because everything he knew from his world of the Mediterranean absolutely depended to function upon slavery. And equally, he's sitting there thinking about, well, how could our worlds be connected in eras before that of Alexander the Great? He talks about the myths and legends that actually have Greek gods like Dionysus and Greek heroes like Heracles wandering through India, and actually in the very mythical origins of time, uniting these great worlds together.
So some of the Indian mythology begins with Greek gods.
Well, I mean, according to Megasthenes, you know, the wonderful thing about when you get into global history is that you realize, well, just like globalism today, everyone's got an opinion, everyone's got a different version of the events as they happened. And, you know, the Greeks and the Romans have a great, if you like, kind of pull on us today because they were awfully good at writing stuff down.
All right, we'll come back and visit more with Michael Scott about ancient worlds, a global history of antiquity. Excuse me, Michael, for stepping in here. On our way to the break, you can join us when we come back in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Michael Scott, historian and classicist at the University of Warwick in England. He steps a bit outside the classicist's box in looking at ways that ancient societies other than the ones centered around the Mediterranean not only influenced today's world, but influenced each other in ways we might not have thought before. His book is called Ancient Worlds, A Global History of Antiquity. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So you mentioned Megasthenes, the first person you talk about in the book, in the 4th century BCE, a Greek man as an ambassador in what we now think of as India. So certainly some connections between cultures. We talked about connections, but perhaps between mythologies here. But how open were ancient societies, I wonder, and can we know, to ideas from abroad, especially when they come in a package with stories about killer ants and men with no mouths and flying serpents we left out?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the killer question, isn't it? You know, what did these people think of one another? And there are, when you dial forward a little bit to the Roman era, to the era of the Roman Empire, you have a moment in time when the Mediterranean world is completely dominated by the Roman Empire. And if you go all the way to the east with the Chinese Qin and Han empires, they too are similarly dominant over a vast way of the people. And these two worlds, these two empires, basically control about half the world's population at this stage. You know, so we're thinking the first couple of centuries AD. And that, you know, for me was another kind of critical kind of question. What did these two mega monsters of empires with completely different ways of thinking and of ruling know and think about one another? And there's some tantalizing details. There's, you know, it's probable that Romans never actually got to China, and equally that the Chinese never got to the Roman Empire and the Mediterranean, but they knew a lot about one another, and they traded vociferously with one another. And one of my favorite stories is in one of the Chinese records of the Huanshu, the Book of the Later Han, where it talks about the people of the Da Qin, the Great Qin, which they gave, that's the title they gave to the Roman Empire. It was a very honorable title. It was calling them after themselves, if you like. And they said that, the quote is that the people from Great Qin are tall and honest, much like ourselves. So, you know, in one of these kind of very early era moments, windows, if you like, into this, to the way in which very different worlds thought about one another, we don't see the bloodshed, the strife, the you know, the killer instinct that, you know, the ancient world gets tarnished with so much. If you think every image of gladiators, etc., in the Roman Empire, actually, what we see is a note of incredible respect and of interest. And that trading link between these two worlds grows vociferously. There's only one sort of note that we also have to where it goes slightly wrong, and it's a wonderful what-if moment, you know, if history could have taken a very different course. And it's in the late 2nd century AD, so about 166 AD, we have a report again in the Chinese sources that some Roman envoys made it to what is now sort of Vietnam. And they claim to be coming on behalf of the Roman emperor, but it's much more likely they were just sort of chancing it themselves, trying to set up some trade deals. And they came with gifts of rhino horn and tortoise shell. And the Chinese sources again sort of respond to this and go, this stuff is neither precious nor rare. Maybe we were a bit mistaken about how great these guys were. You know, so I mean, you just wonder if these nameless envoys had turned up with some better gifts, maybe the whole history of ancient connectivity and global history could have been so different. I mean, it reminds me of a film that came out in I think it was late 2015 in the States and 2016 in the UK that was called Dragon Blade. I don't know whether you ever saw this film, but it had Jackie Chan. It had a whole kind of stellar cast, and it was set on the Silk Roads of antiquity, and it was a sort of fiction, if you like, in which Chinese and Roman soldiers ended up fighting together to preserve the freedom and independence of the Silk Roads, that connective artery of trade that led between East and West, that was simultaneously during the film being dug up by a joint team of American and Chinese archaeologists. And I had this wonderful sense of the malleability of history, that we keep reinventing the story and rethinking what the ancient world was like to suit our own world as much as anything. But there are elements of truth to it, that there was, you know, good congenial interaction between these cultures in the ancient world, even if sometimes that went slightly awry.
Michael Scott is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Ancient Worlds, A Global History of Antiquity. And this raises the question then, I mean, if we're constantly reconsidering based upon new finds what we know about ancient societies, how much of a written record survives from these times? You point this out in the book. It's not great, apparently.
No, I mean, it's very varying. It's like a patchwork quilt with lots of patches missing. You know, we spoke earlier about how the Greeks and Romans were brilliant about writing stuff down, and for one reason or another, lots of it has survived as well. You go, on the other hand, to India, and there are no kind of historical texts that have survived that are akin to the ones we're used to in the Mediterranean, that of Herodotus or Thucydides. What you have there is you're relying on a very different types of evidence, such as inscriptions that are set up on big monumental pillars, or you're looking at much more mythical and religious tales and works. And then if you go to China, again, you're seeing historical texts, but they're being created for very different reasons. So one of the things the Chinese always saw history as being useful for was to help rulers keep on the path of, for a better word, righteousness. But Chinese rulers believe they ruled with what they called the mandate of heaven, and once they erred from a righteous path, you know, they would lose the mandate of heaven and they would lose power. And thus, historians were extremely important people to study the past and help them make sure they didn't make the mistakes of the past. So historians in China were, from the most ancient times, sort of, if you like, almost very well-respected bureaucratic administrative figures. And one of the great historical texts, for instance, is actually titled Comprehensive Mirror to Aid in Government. Right. So, you know, here we've got a world where writing about the past was of fundamental importance to the most important and powerful people in the land, and as a result, survives again. If you go down into Africa, we again have a massive missing patchwork. We're missing those written sources. And what can fill it in, of course, is archaeology and archaeological investigation, and it is beginning to do so in lots of ways. But we still have those tantalizing gaps that we would dearly love to be filled.
There are three major parts to the book, getting a roughly 800-year span in from both before the current era to the current era. And part one is called Politics in an Axial Age. And I have to admit, at the outset, I was starting to think about Arab Spring and the way in which things seem to spring up organically in different places at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, people have argued quite a lot about this term, the Axial Age, since it was first coined by a German historian called Karl Jaspers, sort of after the Second World War, and very much his emphasis, as was many who were interested in global history at the time, was we need to understand one another better in order to avoid future world conflict. And so there was a hugely positive and keen search for moments in the past when the world had seemingly walked in step with each community with one another, and the Axial Age was one of those ideas that this period from the sort of centres around in the 6th century BCE was one in which human civilization, took a giant leap forward in terms of its discoveries in politics and philosophy.
So across
that vast expanse.
So before Athens and the discussion of what led to democracy, I mean, how centralized was power in most societies? Was it really a case of might makes right?
Yes, very much so. I mean, you know, democracy is arguably invented in Athens in this moment of revolution in 508 BC. But there are varying forms of political power out there, and they're able to understand and value and appreciate different kind of political ideas. But it really is only in Athens that direct democracy sort of gets its heyday. There were afterwards many other democracies within the ancient Greek world. I mean, one of the things that makes ancient Greece so fascinating is that it's not one monolithic entity. It's over 1,000 different city-states that are all doing things in their own particular way. So you get sort of every flavor of the rainbow, if you like, in terms of political ideas. But one of the things that studying this part one of politics and then this revolution of ideas that happens almost simultaneously in the Roman world and the Greek world and in China with Confucius that really came home to me while writing it is the fragility of the development of ideas that we now take for granted as part of the furniture, if you like, in our modern world. Democracy didn't get invented overnight in the form that it eventually came to play in Athens or that we would recognize it today. It was a very slow and fragile process where everyone involved didn't know what they were aiming for. They didn't know what they were trying to invent or get to. Every movement and moment was a response to circumstances. It could have gone either way. Its figureheads were very unlikely characters. I mean, the burning reformer who's often credited with inventing democracy was a man in his late 60s, a guy called Cleisthenes. He was an aristocrat. He was, if you like, the last person you would look to come up with an idea like democracy. And so what fascinated me was whether you look at Confucius, whether you look at the rise of republican government in Rome or democracy in Athens, what you get is a renewed appreciation for the fragile and long-term development of things that we now so much take for granted.
Michael Scott, historian and classicist, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is called Ancient Worlds, A Global History of Antiquity, an examination of ways in which ancient societies not only influenced later societies, but also, to some degree, each other. Not quite globalism in the modern sense, but, you know, contacts, certainly. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we explore the topic. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Cleisthenes, you mentioned a rather unlikely candidate for a role in democracy's birth. What produced the chafing for something other than what the system had been up to the time, which is really all people knew, I guess?
It was the involvement of an outside force. What you have in 508 BC in Athens is a public riot, if you like, because the ruler of the city at the time, the Archon, the chief magistrate, had sided with a bunch of Spartan soldiers who had been sort of brought back in to help force through his ideas and his plans. And as ever, you know, you start to think about how little changes in life. One thing most people don't like is being told what to do by people who aren't from their hometown. So you have this wondrous moment of public riot when everyone is up in arms, and in the ensuing melee, the Spartans decide to pack up and leave. It's not worth their trouble. They go home. The magistrate who had been attempting to get them to support him also leaves town. And the people, you can imagine them sort of looking at one another. We're thinking about a community maybe at this stage of probably 20 to 30,000 male citizens. Looking at one another, gathering in the street corners, gathering in the public spaces, saying to one another, what do we do next? you know, what is next? And in that kind of turmoil, in that kind of environment, the ideas that Cleisthenes, this six-year-old, had put forward for how possibly one could run a very different kind of system sort of spread on the wind, if you like, and start to take shape.
And I noticed the name of one of the people who helped spread his ideas, Solon, as somebody who, that's still a term we use for legislators today.
Yeah, I mean, Solon was a guy that the Athenians, you know, looked back to. He'd actually been prevalent in Athens and working on reforms for the city-state almost 100 years before. But his value as a character, his status as a legal reformer was epic. You know, it was a character, a voice, an idea that you could turn to time and time again to talk about how you wanted to do this a similar good to the city of Athens as Solon had done. You know, it's fascinating that when the Romans turned up in Athens about 50 years later, in the middle of the 5th century BCE, their republic was in trouble. It was it had been born at the same time as Athenian democracy, but it had struggled to, if you like, co-align all the competing interests of the different, particularly economic and social classes. And so Roman ambassadors were sent to Athens, who by this time was at the height of its empire and its glory days and its golden age and doing superbly well. These ambassadors were sent over to study what happened in Athens and see what lessons could be learned for Rome. And when they turned up in Athens, they were more interested in what Solon had done, actually, over 100 years, 150 years before by that stage, than they were about the direct democracy that they saw around them. I have this wonderful picture in my head of these Romans turning up who were utterly sure that that there were different political offices that were suited to particular classes, social classes of people. And that was, you know, utterly ingrained in the Roman psyche. Turning up in Athens and seeing what must have seemed to them an absolute free-for-all, as everyone had an equal say in what was being said. You can imagine them looking rather aghast at it all, I think.
So, in fact, people in lower classes in Athens society as it developed could hold public offices?
Absolutely. So in the Athenian system, if you were an Athenian male citizen, right, if you passed that threshold, then you had, within the sort of first 50 years of Athenian democracy, you gained the right to hold any office in the Athenian state. And in fact, you know, over time, it's probable that something like two-thirds of the Athenian male citizen population had direct experience of serving on Athens's most senior governing council, the boule, at some point in their lives. It's an idea that, when you try and compare that to the modern representative democracies that we have today, many people have argued, now with the era of the internet, for instance, can we bring back this much more direct style of interaction and engagement for a much, much bigger population? And I think we're some way away from it now, but it's very tempting to think about ways in which we could do it, particularly with, I don't know what it's like in the States, but in the UK, for instance, voter engagement is down, youth engagement is down with politics. You know, how do you get people involved and engaged in helping to run the state around them? And what the Greeks did, and what particularly Athens did brilliantly, was to create a culture in which it was absolutely just part and parcel of what you did as a citizen was to get involved in politics. In ancient Greek, and particularly in Athens, the word for a private citizen, somebody who didn't engage in public discussions and in public office and in politics, the word in ancient Greek is idiotes. It's our word idiot. Right? So it was a real term of disparagement for somebody who turned their cheek away from thinking about, how their city and how their culture was run.
Well, let's talk about, though, how Rome broke away from the idea of autocracy. The tale begins, apparently, with a son of the king who wanted a woman. What happened?
Like all good stories, right? We know very little about it, to be utterly true. But this is the story that is told by the Romans themselves in later years. And this is very much what they saw as sparking their own revolution, which they later dated. When later historians were looking back and trying to date the moment of the Roman Revolution, they looked around them, and what they looked to and saw was, well, the Greeks, the Athenians, had their revolution against their masters in this year, and it sort of works, doesn't it? If we date ourselves to the same period. So, you know, as they're trying to actually put a date on these great moments, they're searching around for different comparative moments in other cultures and aligning themselves with it. But yes, yeah, so sometime 509, 508 BC, there is clearly trouble at the top as the last king of Rome, Tarquinius Superbus, is out of town, and his sons get up to a lot of mischief, enough to incite the people of Rome to close the doors to him when he tries to come back home.
It was a lockout in the truest sense of the word. We'll pick that story up on the other side of a break. The book is called Ancient Worlds, A Global History of Antiquity. It's by Michael Scott, who is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Michael, and we have some phone calls waiting. We will take those as well when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is an associate professor of ancient history and classics at the University of Warwick in England, Michael Scott. He's also the author of several books and a broadcast presenter, both on TV and radio for BBC, National Geographic, and so forth. His latest book is called Ancient Worlds, A Global History of Antiquity, which raises the issue of the fact that we tend to focus narrowly on ancient Greece and Rome. And the fact is that there was a lot more going on in the world at the time, and there were interrelationships between cultures back then, not just influences on today's world, but influences on each other as well. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we talked about the more or less simultaneous revolution in Athens and in Rome. One produced a democracy for Athens. The other one produced a republic system in Rome. And we talked about Tarquinius Superbus getting locked out of the city of Rome. Did he ever get back in to rule again?
He did not, and despite the fact that he sort of called on every favor he had with all the sort of neighboring kings of the Etruscans and so forth to sort of batter down the doors of Rome. But Rome and its new republic stood tall, not without its problems. You know, there were moments when the soldiers, the foot soldiers, if you like, went on strike and just sort of left the city and all went and sat on a hill outside. You know, went, well, we've had enough of this. We're not getting enough payback for the effort we're putting in. And there's a really interesting conversation that takes place, as it's later recorded by the historian Livy, and the supposedly the Roman negotiator who's sent by the aristocrats, the Roman Senate, says, look, this is how you have to think about the Roman state, that there are there is the belly and there are the limbs. Now, the belly can't survive without the limbs, because the limbs are needed to feed the belly. But equally, the limbs can't survive without the belly, because you won't get any nourishment. You know, we need one another. Think of ourselves as a human body that can work in symbiosis. We need one another. And we have to find a way to work together, which they do, you know, incredibly successfully. Of course, eventually over time, the Roman Republic expands to control vast swathes of the Mediterranean. And then, of course, when it turns into empire, it becomes one of the greatest civilizations, you know, known to man. So there are kind of key moments of decision making and thought where you start to get a sense of real, I guess it's the accident of ideas, you might want to call it, that, you know, no one is waking up one morning with a perfect vision in their head of what republican government should look like in Rome, be it democracy in Athens, or indeed Confucius over in China at the same time thinking up his ideas about how to be the best ruler. It's all developing slowly over time in response to different circumstances and most often in response to crises.
Let us take a call. We have Lucy in Mendocino on the line. Thanks for waiting, and welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Scott.
Thank you. One of the things about history that has really interested me over my life is the Christian history of the three wise men from the Orient who were passing through Roman-occupied land of Palestine or Jude, you know, where the Jews were living, and this baby was born and then eventually disappears into Egypt with his parents. Were these wise men from India and going to Egypt? And were there therapy centers there for people? Or do you know anything about that?
All right. Thanks for the question, Lucy. Appreciate it.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right that the story of the birth of Jesus is taking place very much within the context of the eastern borders of the Roman Empire. And, you know, it's a time of real change and difficulty during the time of Jesus' life. The Romans are very keen to make sure that the eastern borders of their empire are stable. And, you know, that's a huge, the important kind of reason behind why the Roman governors, you know, particularly Pontius Pilate, ends up in many ways acting as he did. The three wise men, as you call them, so they are often referred to in the Greek text as magi. Now, these guys magi have a long history coming from the Near East. And they, where they're coming from exactly, and where they're going to, I'm afraid I can't give a specific answer to your question. But they would be figures with which both the Greeks and the Romans and people kind of the Mediterranean world would be very familiar.
Outside of Scripture, is there much mention of magi?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you see them a lot, you know, kind of, well, go back to the era of the Greeks, thinking about the Persians, very much the kind of, they're talking about the magi there, and then they're known and understood and thought about. It comes over into the Latin as well, that, you know, they use the same word, the magi. So, yes, these are kind of people that we hear about on a fairly regular basis, but the particular ones that the Scriptures talk about, we have very little idea.
Okay, back to the idea of new governmental systems sprouting up in the 6th century BCE. Take us to the state of Lu in China, and I love the image you provide of Confucius shaking his head in disgust at Duke Ding.
Yeah. Well, you know, here's a guy. While Confucius's ideas, and it's a system of political governance, if you like, that has had a massive influence on the history of China in future centuries, but also the world as a result. But crucially, you know, at the time, Confucius dies, a man completely unsuccessful in really getting any major ruler, let alone of his own state of Lu, to adhere to his ideas, and not least because they are extraordinarily difficult and hard to match up to Confucius's standards. You know, there he is, kind of shaking his head sorrowfully at Zhu Ding, who's been distracted by the cunning ruse of his aristocrats underneath him, who have sort of distracted him with a bunch of dancing girls. But Confucius goes off on a tour of the other Chinese states at the time and tries to find other rulers who might sort of live up to this or be able to adhere to this idea for what a perfect ruler should do and act like in his head, and he can't find anyone. And really, he dies a man, not a broken man's probably a bit too strong. You know, he still has his followers, he still has his disciples, but certainly not in any way as successful as his ideas would later go on to become. And in fact, his ideas at the time were just one of 100 schools of thought. You know, the era is also known as the 100 schools of thought era, for how best to rule and how to be the best ruler that are out there. You know, there are lots of others floating around that at the time of Confucius' life and death seem to have been much more tipped for success. And again, it's another story of the fragility of the development of ideas, but also the accident of ideas as to how Confucianism eventually ends up winning out and becoming the guiding mandate for the Chinese state for centuries to come.
Well, that is the thing that intrigues me the most about all three examples, Rome, Athens, and the state of Lu in China, is the idea that people were chafing for something other than what they had. And I have to believe that's what drove, Kong Fu Zi is his real name, but Confucius is what we know him as. So was he saying, well, I'll know what it is when I'll see it, and this isn't it?
Well, I mean, he was developing. I mean, he had an idea. He had a set of ideas that revolved around ceremony, ritual, genealogy, manners, the idea that you need to be continually learning, continually self-improving. These were all kind of, you know, difficult concepts to adhere to in real life if you had your hands and arms in the messy business of politics in an era which is, you know, known as the warring, the end of the sort of spring and autumn annals period and into the warring states period when Chinese states are fighting for their lives it was pretty hard to rule as Confucius outlined. And there's a wonderful quote in the Analects, the Sayings of Confucius, that I think just sums it all up beautifully. And it's a saying that one of his disciples turned up at an inn and mentioned the name Confucius, and the innkeeper looks up and goes, "Oh, you mean the man who knows it's no good but keeps on trying anyway?" So I have this wonderful image of a man who was not easy to get on with, who was demanding something more of some of the most powerful people in his world, who were not used to being told that their best was not good enough, and yet, you know, his ideas would come to be so influential. And yet, you know, if you dial it forward to much more modern history and think about China in the 20th century, Confucius became, having been the dominant mandate of Chinese government for centuries, became the enemy, was utterly eradicated. They even dug up his grave to make sure that he was really dead. You know, such was the hatred of Confucius during the 20th century. And yet now, as China searches for something which it can claim to be its own and something which it could offer up as a kind of alternative to Western liberalism and democracy, Confucianism is starting to have a real place again in China. So it's a wondrous story of how these ideas that were all born in the same moment have had incredibly long and difficult and interesting lives. And none of them have managed to stay the course the whole way without having periods in the gloom and the shadows.
Well, and as you point out, there were a couple periods of exile for Confucius within his life, and then it sounds like that the Maoists kind of worked him over pretty well as well. It's interesting to know that ideas will lose favor and then perhaps come back into favor.
Well, I mean, I think democracy is one of the best to think about that. The Romans did a pretty good job of rubbishing the name of democracy. You know, effectively, the Romans tagged democracy with the idea of mob rule. You know, it was not a good system of way of doing things. It was a disgrace. And when you look at the dialogues of the founding fathers of the U.S. Constitution, when they're sitting there having their debates and ideas about what the American system of government should look like, a lot of the time, a lot of them are referring back to the ancient Greeks, the Romans, the Mediterranean powers, as to how their systems worked and what were the best bits and what, you know, worked well and what didn't work so well. And when you look at those dialogues, you know, they are still buying the idea that democracy is mob rule. There's a great one, I think it's Madison saying, you know, even if every Athenian citizen had been a Socrates, even if every Athenian citizen had been one of the brightest, you know, men of that era, Athenian democracy would still have been a mob rule situation. So there's fascinating ways in which the color, if you like, the sort of smell of these ideas could be completely changed through the filter of different cultures through which they passed, and we're doing that again today with them.
I really enjoyed the discussion of politics. I want to make sure we do touch at least a bit on the part two of the book of Ancient Worlds about the war, and particularly Hannibal in the Alps. This is such a famous story. Why?
Oh, I think it's the story of a great military leader doing something which people thought was impossible. And, you know, military leaders through the ages have wanted to bring up the story of Hannibal to be able to compare themselves to Hannibal, to be able to sort of put themselves in the same bracket as Hannibal. I mean, there was a very interesting article that had just been released in one of the scientific journals where they claim to have basically found the animal dung. They found the remains of what must have been huge numbers of animals, particularly elephants and pack horses and mules and things like that, going over one particular pass in the Alps. It's always been a bit of a mystery which pass through the Alps Hannibal used, and the scientists claim to have solved the mystery by following the trail of feces, basically. But it is an incredible achievement, and it was the Romans, the enemy, were the first people. Indeed, they were the ones shouting loudest, saying what an amazing achievement it was. They are the ones. It's their sources. It's not Hannibal. We don't actually have a single written source, really, by Hannibal or any of his kind of contemporaries or compatriots in the Carthaginian camp. It's all the Romans, the enemy, talking about quite what a masterful man he was, but also a man with the worries of being assassinated. There's a great story that I love that he would wander around even within his own camp wearing different wigs to try and avoid detection, so that, you know, people wouldn't be able to sort of identify him and try and assassinate him. And you know, this second moment, if you like, that the book focuses on, which is the end of the 3rd century and the beginning of the 2nd century BCE, for me is a crucial time in which the ancient world knits together across its vastest expanse from the Mediterranean to China. So you have the journey of Hannibal and the wars that take place in the Mediterranean in this period that really lead to Roman dominance, mastery over the Mediterranean. At exactly the same time over in China, you have the state of Qin finally emerging from this long war of attrition with other states to take over and create for the first time a unified China. And then over the following 50 years or so, the repercussions of those two events lead to a meeting of these worlds in Central Asia, when for the first time ever, the historical texts of China and the historical texts of Rome relate the same incident, a battle at the city of Bactria.
Yeah, some great stuff in here that indicates how the ancient world influenced us and how ancient societies influenced each other as well. The book is called Ancient Worlds, A Global History of Antiquity. Michael Scott wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Michael, thank you.
Thanks very much, Jim.